Did you hear that too? Or was that just me?
We heard it.
Oh, okay, great. Good evening, one and all. We're going to get started. For those who are just signing in, I apologize. We'll have to end a little early this evening, I imagine. But this Parashat Shlach, is a profoundly pivotal moment in the trajectory of Jewish history. It is the moment where Bamidbar unravels. We spoke about this to some degree last week, where complaining broke out, when Aaron and Miriam start to gossip, but they were still on track to go to Israel. It was still in the works that we were weeks away from making it to the Jordan River. And this week, that all comes crashing down, where from what we colloquially refer to as the sin of the spies, led to 4 decades of wandering. And there are so many questions that crop up in this episode. The first one, of course, being who decided to send spies? Whose idea was it?
Hashem's.
So Mark's answer seems to be the most intuitive. What are the first words of the parasha? Anybody know the first 3 words? Give you a clue. The first one is the name of the parasha. There you go. Excellent. Yes. Shlach lecha and Hashem. Send for yourselves people. And how did last week finish? What was the end of last week's parasha? Balotcha? It was Balotcha last week, right?
Miriam.
The episode with Miriam getting stricken with leprosy, and God intervening to defend Moshe's honor, full stop, end of story. And then out of nowhere, God says, send for yourself people. So it wasn't precipitated by Jews saying, we need this. It wasn't an idea. It seems on the surface, it didn't kind of come out as a groundswell, a grassroots demand. This was God top down saying to Moses, send forth people. Now, the way that Moshe reports these events toward the end of his life in Devarim, where he goes over history, he does add some details we don't get here, where he suggests that actually they were all clamoring at Moshe saying, we need something. But that's not given in the divinely dictated order of the chronology that we get here in Shlach Lecha. So there's a lot of ambiguity around whose idea was this. And Hashem seems to want to take credit for this idea. And that does address a number of issues around the whole idea of sending spies. If it's such a terrible idea, why does God let it happen? Never mind endorse it. Why does he let it happen? Why does Moshe let it happen? There are all sorts of questions that will crop up as we read through. And what I'd like to do is summarize, as always, how things unfold in the parasha. And it will end on a very strange note. And my hope is that that note may speak to a larger issue that looms over the entire parasha, which we'll come to, which is the deceit of visual life, the ability for aesthetics and appearances to mislead us, for our eyes to trick us. That is going to be the looming theme over most of what unfolds in this parsha, and we'll see how it comes to a close. So in the beginning, Shachan Hashem, God says, send forth men. And of course, if we were to put parsha under pressure, exegetical pressure on all of the terms of every verse, we could be here for an eternity, and it's all worth it. The word lecha has a lot of emphasis on it. Shlach lecha and Hashem, send for yourselves men. In what way does this serve the Jewish people? That question is answered by a number of the commentators. It's also worth noting, what does the word anashim mean? How would you translate it?
Literally men.
Important
people.
Men of distinction.
People of importance.
Very interesting. Okay, so Mark gave us the straightforward men. We had Chip say people, maybe important people. Grace said people as well. I think Debbie said men of, someone said men of distinction, and maybe that was Chip. But collectively, men of distinction, which is fascinating to me, because how do we translate the word enosh when it's in the singular, usually, as distinct from the word ish? John Leo, I thought you were unmuted for a moment.
Human.
Enosh is human, as opposed to ish, which would be?
Person.
Person. Okay, interesting. So it sounds like I'm playing a pedantic game, but usually, at least in the context of the Psalms, King David, who perhaps most famously uses synonyms all the time with, apparently, at least for the Malbim, assuming slight distinction in their meaning. And usually ish is translated as a person of distinction, and enosh has the connotation of frailty and weakness. Ma enosh ki tizkereno. What is humanity that it deserves our attention? That's the kind of tone that is expressed in the word enosh. It kind of refers to human weakness. So shlach lecha anashim, though we translated it as men of distinction, it does seem to indicate also that God says send people who are human, send people who are weak, which is almost setting the people up to fail. Why would I send weak people? So that opens up a can of worms as to what is God planning here. Now, there is, of course, the question as to why God lets them do this. If God knows that this is going to be a drastic failure, and the assumption is the people ask for this, why does he permit it? People ask for things all the time and are told no. And there is a suggestion among a couple of the commentators that even though if we were to put this into statistical terms, it was a 70-30 likelihood that this was going to be catastrophic, God did not want to stop this because the people in the terminology of the rabbis came be'irbuvia. They kind of came en masse to Moses and said, we need scouts. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, I can't shut this down because it is so determinative for the people. And what's about to unfold is a huge shift. They're about to leave the desert, become independent, run their own governance. They should be prepared for what's ahead. And I can't close their eyes and pull the wool over them before they come here. And if it means that they're going to fail, that's what it means. Sometimes you have to let them fail. And I'm not going to jump in with, you know, too big to fail economic comments. But in at least social terms, God seems to indicate here that our people, our nation, is not too big to fail. That if we treat us as a nation on eggshells and we shield us from the obstacles to stop us failing, it can't end well either. We need to be prepared. And God says, send forth people. And Hashem, and I understand they're weak. I understand they're frail. I understand they might fail. But they need to see what's ahead in order to take on this mission. I'm not sending anybody in blind. They need to know what is coming. And of course, in I don't need to list off the movies for you or the television episodes where you've got a group about to go into battle and the general, the captain or the head of arms says, look, I'm not going to lie to you. It is quite likely that many of us are not going to come home. You know, think of Braveheart or think of, you know, whichever scene you want to. But understand that what we're about to embark on is highly dangerous. And you can go home. And in fact, that's the way that Jewish military ethics would work. We have this described in Devarim in more detail when we get to Kites El Milchama. People who were scared were sent home. No one was lied to about what was ahead. And here, HaKadosh Baruch Hu exhibits this not just on a military plane, but on a national plane, that we need to be prepared as a people for what lies ahead and confront the truth, even if it means we might fail and balk at the opportunity, which is inevitably what happens. So Moshe is told to send people. He selects 12 heads of the tribes to go. One name is changed. Whose name is changed?
Yehoshua.
His name is changed to what?
Yehoshua.
Excellent. Yehoshua. It began as Hoshea and a yud was added. And it is peculiar. Why did Moshe change Hoshea's name to Yehoshua? What was the purpose of changing his name alone? There were 12 going. Why did he only change Yehoshua's name? So in isolation, why do people's names get changed? I mean, think about the history. Whose names get changed over the biblical record? We've got Abraham. Sarah. Anybody else?
Yaakov
is changed to Israel. Right. Names are changed at pivotal moments in their lives, usually to inject a signal of divinity, whether it's a hey or a shift to Kel being at the end of the name. And here Hoshea has a yud added, a signal of divinity as well. But why is Yeshua's name being changed now? What is unfolding for him? Why does Moses want to do this? This doesn't come from on high. This isn't an angel. This isn't God telling him to do it. This is Moses' decision to change Hoshea's name.
Because he was a descendant of Yosef.
Oh, so Steve jumps in. That is the view of the Torah Tumima. And Steve operates like the greatest of Jewish sages that leaves you with a very short remark that we don't know what to do with. Luckily enough, I think I know what he's inferring. So we'll come to Steve's point. The usual way to read this is that Moshe is trying to shore up Joshua's success. The question that is begged by this, that Moshe is praying to protect Yeshua and so that he should succeed. We know how the story ends. Who ends up succeeding here? Who is the liability on this trip? And you don't have to give me names, obviously, but of the 12 spies or scouts or princes, who are the liability?
Kalev.
Is Kalev a liability?
No.
He ends up succeeding, right? He tells the truth, or he stands firm. Yeshua stands firm. It's the other 10. So the question that is begged by Moshe praying for Yeshua's success is, hold on, number one, if Moshe's praying for the mission's success, pray for everybody. Why are you just praying for one? Number one. Number two, if you're only going to pray for some, why are you paying for the guy who's not a liability? Yeshua, what's his vocation been for the last few years since Moshe returned to Egypt?
Assistant to Moshe. Assistant.
He was the Moshe's teaching assistant and cleaning assistant and escort and bagman or whatever it's called in the American presidential context. He was, washing Moshe's feet, carrying his thing. He was at his side. If there was anybody who Moshe understood had the potential to do this, it was Yosh or Hoshea. So why on earth, if you're going to select just a small group to shore up their confidence, why would you pick Yoshua as opposed to the others? And it almost smacks of nepotistic tendencies that Moshe says, oh, I care about Yoshua. I care about Hoshea. He's my guy, so I'm going to pray for him. What about the mission? What about the others? And what Steve refers to, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Steve, is that the Torah Tumima suggests in a note that actually Moshe thought that Hoshea was the liability. It wasn't that he was his friend. He didn't think, I'm just going to pray for him. And it wasn't even, in theory, you could say he thought Yoshua would be the leader. He understood Hoshea's potential. And he said, he's going to end up leading this group. So I'll pray for his defense in the same way that we might pray for a president or a prime minister. I'm going to pray for the head scout. But the Torah Tumim suggests that's not why Moshe prayed for Joshua. He thought he was a liability, a major liability. Steve, why was he a liability?
He talked too much.
Because he what?
He talked too much.
Right. If we cast our memories back all the way to the beginning of Parashat Vayeshev, when things start to unfold for the biblical patriarchs, where we had a neat division between after Avram, we had Yitzchak versus Yishmael, we had Yaakov versus Esav, and then Yaakov's children, everything breaks loose. And Yosef is sold, cast in a pit, nearly killed. And what precipitated, in many ways, Yosef's downfall? Why did his brothers hate him so much?
Dreams.
Did they hate him for the dreams?
He was the favorite.
Okay, so there are a couple of factors here. So Seth points out he snitched on them. Diane says he was the favorite. And Mark
sound on.
Okay.
Say again. And Mark said it was the dreams, I think.
Neither one of us.
Telling the dreams.
So it's in many ways a combination of all these factors, right? Meaning him having the dreams, that's not his fault. What is his fault is coming up to them and saying, guess what happened last night? You know, I had this yesterday. My daughter woke me up at 4 a.m. and made me come into her room because she had bad dreams. And that's okay because she wasn't showing off that she had a vision about me bowing down to her at some point in the future. But that's what Yosef does. He wakes up his brothers and he says, hey, guys, guess what? I had a dream and you are going to bow at my feet. They think, oh, how sweet, you self-obsessed, narcissistic, egotistical threat to the Jewish future. And for many of the traditional commentators who are loath to critique our ancestors, they understand the brothers' otherwise inexcusable behavior to sell or kill or maim their own flesh and blood as essentially a way to save the Jewish future. I think Malbim is the most explicit in his description of this theory, but it's taken broadly by some of the medieval figures as well, that the brothers were trying to shield the Jewish future and they saw Yosef as a threat. They said that every successive generation has had to isolate a threat to the Jewish future, whether it was Yishmael or Esav. And our guy, they say, oh, obviously our guy is going to be Yosef. And the fact that he's from lowercase f, so to speak, in code, doesn't matter because Esav in lowercase terms was from as well. He cared about his father. He was a heroic celebrant of Kibbud Av Va'em, and yet he was a threat to our future because of his self-obsession, because of his materialism. And the brothers think, well, Yosef, he plays with his hair a lot. He talks about his dreams. He's pampered. He's a threat. We have to isolate him and get rid of him. And that's why they do what he does. And whether one takes that view of the brothers or not, it seems ubiquitous in tradition that Yosef was a, I don't know the turn of phrase, a telltale, a tattletale, whatever the turn of phrase is. He, or the way Seth put it, he's a snitch. He would, tradition has it that he would tell on his brothers. He would bring their dibat ra'ah. He would bring a bad report to his parents about his brothers were misbehaving. And what Steve is referring is that Hoshea, we know, because of the list of genealogy, is a descendant of Yosef. He is from the tribe that comes from Yosef. And Moshe thought to himself, if any of them are going to bring a bad report, let me look at the genealogy. Let me think about the past. And it can come from the most unexpected circumstances. Hoshea has been at my side all this time. But under the right stress, given the right circumstance, the greatest of people can fail and fall and betray themselves. And what will Moshe ends up doing is saying, I need to defend Yahushua from the liability of his gene pool. So I'm going to change his name to protect him from that Josephian instinct to tattletale or bring a bad report. And by the way, was Yosef telling the truth or not when he tattletaled on his brothers? Was it made up or was it true?
True.
So it wasn't like he was a liar. He was just a tattletale. So what this stream of thought seems to presume is that Moshe recognizes there is a bad truth out there. Well, bad is a judgment, a value judgment. So let's not say bad. But there is a challenging mission ahead that a truthful report could be badly crafted. And I need to insulate Yahushua from an instinct to bring a bad report because, yes, what they're going to see could be bad. And that is actually going to be one of the most astonishing things is when we see the spies come back and report on their mission, they don't really lie. They just put a bad spin on what they saw. Did they see obstacles? Were there fortified cities? Were there population centers? Were there warriors? Yes. Were there giant produce there? Yes, it seems. So they didn't lie. And when Kalev stands up and he rebukes them, he doesn't say, you're liars. He doesn't say that's not true. He says, Alona Aleh, we need to go. As if it doesn't matter. We've been promised. We need to make it. So there is implicit in that very technical, formulaic name change right at the start that could just be seen as a blessing for a mission, at least for the tradition of the Torah Tamima. This is Moshe recognizing at the same time that Yeshua needs help to be insulated, that this mission has the potential to bring the people down, and that the truth might hurt, and there needs to be attention on how to express the truth, and how to, and that will play into the theme of how sites can be misleading, how what they're about to see, if they just merely report what they've seen, it can be hugely problematic. And I mean, you don't need me to say this, but what we saw over the last month is just more evidence how visual scenes can firstly play on our emotions, but also mislead. Over the last month, I'm sure many of us saw images out of Gaza that, you know, I try to do an experiment to myself, try to imagine myself as a neutral observer. Imagine I don't know the background, I don't know the context, and I'm just for the first time in my life seeing an image. And I'm not going to say universally, because there are people who support the Palestinian cause who have been devoted to it for their whole lives. But if you go to a secular campus in the United States and you've got people who've got not the faintest idea what Palestinian cause is, where Israel is, how big it is, the history, but they just know I'm involved in this cause. In fact, the University of Chicago, which, in case I forget, we will not be having a share next week because I'll be on a plane. So that's just apologies. But there was a whole brouhaha there last week because there was a new incoming student government and the SJP on campus. Anyone know what SJP stands for? There you go. Students for Justice in Palestine. In fact, when I was in school at the University of Chicago and attending classes, there was one moment when the horrific spree of stabbings took off. I can't remember how many years ago it was. I guess it was 3-4 years ago, where there was just a repeated spate of stabbings all over the state of Israel. The Hillel group, I think it was the Hillel group, put up signs around campus saying SJP, stabbing Jews for peace, to kind of mock the cause of these people who are defending the indefensible. And one of my less level-headed professors at the time was very confused. And it's like, why are they so proud to stick up posters that they're stabbing Jews for peace? I mean, it's unbelievable that they're just like, you're willing to put this up. And I had to say, actually, that was the Jewish students who were mocking their defenses. They weren't proudly saying we stab Jews for peace. But either way, the SJP, there was one member of the incoming student government who released a statement on behalf of all the student bodies saying that the university should boycott Israel and withdraw, and condemns everything Israel does. And it's astonishing to me that, that statements can ignore 4,000 rockets. I mean, even just pay lip service to it, you would imagine. But it's just like, no, that's not worthy of condemnation. It's astonishing. But it strikes me, why are people who have no background, no connection, no particular interest, so swayed by the cause, more now than in any time in American history? They look at polls and sympathy for the plight of the Palestinians is on the rise in the United States. It used to be, I think, like an 80-20 issue, and now it's more like a 60-40 issue, which I should say, nobody should, you know, pack their bags right now because of fear. I mean, it's still astonishingly blessed that we have 60% of the American population who recognizes the reality there. But these people who have no attachment, all they see is images of children standing in rubble with their teddy bears next to a dead sibling. And let's be honest, if I had no connection to that, and that's all I saw pummeled into my imagination every day, how could I not have sympathy for that cause? If the narrative that I'm being given is, look at these pictures, how horrific it is, and I'm not given context, and I'm not given the history. And I you know, media is to some degree intentionally to blame for this. To some degree, the whole medium of media does not lend itself to context in any sphere and can't do justice to any situation. But what we'll see unfolding, lahavdil, that was just for the context, in this parsha is that visual images have a unique capacity to leave impressions on our emotions and our moral instincts. And what the essentially the failure of our ancestors in this week's parasha is the inability to transcend the visual image, the inability to recognize context, history, obligation, duty, justice, and actually be blinded by sight in many ways, being blinded by what they see with their eyes. And Kalev's answer is not you've seen wrong, but you have misdiagnosed our job. Our job is not to just look, but alona aleh, it is to move forward. And that's how Kalev responds. There's a huge amount more to say. And I feel terrible kind of building up that way and saying, well, I need to wrap up in a moment because I do. As I said, I need to end a little early this evening. But we'll just finish with a kind of capstone to this, which is after the trauma of the spies' mistake and the people breaking out in tears and our dreams falling apart and the people being sentenced to 4 decades of itinerancy. Am I blurring or can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, my image was blurring, but don't be fooled by the image. Is after everything falls apart, and by the way, parenthetically, if the Jews are not allowed to go to Israel and God says, right, breaks, 40 years you can't go, what could God have said they have to do for 40 years? What would be the simplest thing that they could do if they're not allowed to go in? What should
stay
they
where
do?
They are.
Stay put. You would think God would say, right, you can't go. So Arba'im Shana for 40 years, you're staying right here. You're keeping camp. And he says, for 40 years, you're going to wander aimlessly for 40 years. And it's worth pondering, and I'm not going to answer, I'll leave this with you to consider, is why would God say, you can't go in, but I'm going to make you walk? And no, it is not connected to my Noom diet, for those who are interested. It is not to make sure that they don't become sedentary. Or maybe it is. But why does God say, you need to be moving for 4 decades? And I'll leave that with you. But the parasha finishes with fringes, with tzitzit. And in many ways, it seems like an odd way to end. But it is an embodiment of this ethic that we say every time we say the Shema. Lo taturu acharei levavchem v'acharei eineichem. The word taturu, what does the word taturu mean? The root being tor?
The
so tor means to follow, it's translated sometimes as being misled, but it means do not follow after. La tor et ha'aretz is precisely what the scouts are sent to do, to tour the land, to follow through. But what they failed to do was la tor et ha'aretz, to see the whole picture. And we're told at the end, don't be misled by your heart, by your eyes. And tzitzit in many ways is the ritual prompt to not be misled by sight. Because what is the point of tzitzit? What is it meant to do when one sees the fringes? What is one meant to imagine?
The stream of consciousness that brings you to look upward to heaven. Through the blue and tchelet and horizon.
Right, the way that Chazal formulate is, you look at the blue of the fringe, the tchelet, and that reminds you of the ocean. Then you look at the ocean, that reminds you of the sky. You look at the sky, and that reminds you of heaven and God. And that stream of consciousness, as Debbie put it, all that triggered pattern is to suggest that we ought never to linger on an image. The stream, it could have just said, look at the tzitzit and think of God. But it purposefully, the sages understood that the stream of consciousness is the Jewish aesthetic, which I won't go into now, but on Shavuot night, the subject that I covered was Judaism and art, or Jews and art, or art and idolatry, which picked up on this theme. But firstly, not everybody was there. And secondly, not everybody was conscious who was there, including myself. So I wouldn't have felt terrible going over it. But the bottom line aesthetic seems to be that for Jewish thought, art is not inherently bad, but art that consumes the viewer is an evil. An art that makes me stop in my tracks and pacifies me, that petrifies me, not in the sense that it scares me, but that it petra turns me into stone, that it just absorbs me, that is a problem, because that is being misled by the emotional aesthetic of visual life. And Judaism wants us to see things, but not just to see them, to react to them, to invest it with sanctity, to see, sit, and not just think of fringes, but to think of the ocean and the sky of God, and then move forward through that stream of consciousness. And the failure of our ancestors here was to be misled by an image, which I will spend more time talking about over Shabbat in the drasha. But in the meantime, and if you want to be teased a little bit about the drasha for Shabbat, I'm going to ask you to consider what the mastodon has to do with the spies. But in the meantime, I'm afraid we're going to have to close now. But I wish you all a wonderful Shabbat, a healthy Shabbat, a restful Shabbat, and a Shabbat where we are not caught by the image, but inspired by our mission. So I wish you all a Shabbat Shalom. And with God, I will see you all over the course of Shabbat.
All right, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat.